It's a scandal trifecta here in D.C. between Benghazi, the IRS, and the AP subpoenas. Can the White House get out of their own way? Is this a big deal for the White House, and how are they going to handle it? We'll analyze all of that, and we'll have special guest Salisha Wilkin, AP News Writer of the Year for Oklahoma. She'll be on to talk about the crossing of the lines between government and the press. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics. To join the discussion, you can call toll-free 1-877-662-3713. And now, the moderator of Backroom Politics, Justin Russell.
Roundtable talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics Live on Block Talk Radio, broadcasting from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
Hello, how are you today?
Doing fantastic. To my 12 o'clock, he is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation, former floor chief for then-Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Justin, and I want to report that the IRS has not found me yet.
No, they're looking. They're looking. To his left, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, last serving under, last count, 4 presidents, longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a distinguished and very charming fellow from the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And to my right, he is the former chairman of the Democrat Party in the great state of Maryland, longtime Washington insider, Carl Tooven. Hi, Carl.
Hello out there. Hello, Justin and everybody. Good to be here.
Our female portion of the show, Denise Krepp, is in London this week. She sends her regards, but she will not be joining us, as is it's close to bedtime there in London. Hey, it is literally just drinking from a fire hose on what to start with. There is so much going on since we last broadcast live 2 weeks ago. It is amazing what is going on, and the White House continues to spin in turmoil trying to deal with all these. It is a trifecta of second term issues, scandals, however you want to look at it. Where do we start? I say we start on the latest, on the last week's discussion, which is the issue on Benghazi. For those of you who have not been following Benghazi, late last year, September 11th, 2012, a terrorist attack was undertaken against our U.S. consulate in the city of Benghazi, Libya. The attack not only killed our ambassador in Libya, but it also took the lives of 3 additional personnel there traveling with the ambassador. Since that attack, we have seen UN Ambassador Susan Rice saying that it was just a rowdy group of individuals who were responding to a video, an anti-Muslim video that was put out on YouTube. We've also since seen intelligence reports that have been confirmed by allied intelligence agencies that this, in fact, was an act of terrorism. It was a planned terrorist attack. Last week, the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee held a hearing regarding this issue, and it turned out. I'm sorry, House Oversight Committee. There's so many things going on, it's amazing. House Oversight Committee.
I think the attack took less time than you're talking.
Well, I'm trying to set the stage here, folks. House Oversight Committee, led by Chairman Darylis, has undertaken the investigation and called 3 key witnesses including the charge of the affairs in Libya at the time, the regional security officer at the time, and a security specialist, former DS agent. So much to start with. Number one, I want to start with you, Alan Moore. This is something that has really got the White House on edge and really nervous about the backlash of this. How actually big is this possibly to the administration?
This is a fascinating thing. A few days ago, there it looked like the in isolation, it looked like the Republicans might overreach on this issue. There's stuff here. There's important stuff here, regardless of the dismissive comments that the president made, which earned him, by the way, this morning, from the fact checker of the Washington Post, not one, not two, not three, but four full Pinocchios for a comment he made just yesterday about Benghazi. Having said that, it was interesting question. The Republicans have a tendency to overreach. Both parties do. But let me remind. But what happened since then was, as you point out, the IRS scandal, which it is, and then the AP scandal, which it is. The technical term for this, for what's happened to the White House, this is a shitstorm. That's the technical term.
It's a family show. Remember that, Alan. But that is a term I love.
It is absolutely amazing what's happened in 5 days. Benghazi suddenly, it fits into a pattern of bad actions, bad decision making, and different levels of covering up what happened. This is a disaster for any White House, including this one. Benghazi is now part of the larger narrative and gets a different level and kind of attention than it would have even 5 days ago.
Before we get into the politics of this, let's look at the actual response of this. You're talking about a situation where we have an ambassador, a seated ambassador is killed, three support personnel are also killed, and there is a series, apparently, of emails that have gone between the embassy in Tripoli and State Department headquarters in Foggy Bottom here in D.C. that say, look, we've asked for more and more security. Bob Hines, we were talking about it before. It seems that this wasn't a communications issue. This was an issue beyond all concept. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's clear that for some reason, whatever it is, and I don't know, there was no security with the ambassador in any real sense. I mean, here's our highest ranking official in the country. He is in a city which is almost totally, I wouldn't say totally out of control, but it's a very loosely run place. There's no really strong government in that area. There's no official body of there's no police or army or anything like that to protect, and we had no the usual situation in any kind of a diplomatic location of the United States is to have some Marines around to be a guard for that the diplomatic official who's in that community. We didn't seem to have any there at all in Benghazi on the night of the attack.
What it seemed that if the regional security officer in Tripoli says, look, we are shorthanded, it is a very tenable situation right now, that Foggy Bottom would have, or at least Department of State Security, would have said, hey, we got to make some changes here. We got to move on this. What is the holdup possibly?
Well, I haven't the faintest idea what the holdup is. I have no idea why there was no response.
Is it Alan Moore?
Well, the department has said we have constrained resources. Fair enough. Everybody knows that. Then the question is, if you're not protected, why do you go? And, I mean, I feel for the loss of these people, not least of all the ambassador who had done fabulous work. But one wonders why on 9/11 he went there at all, given what was known to be a very exposed situation.
Well,
now,
in defense of that, though, I mean, you're talking about a city where the Americans were largely held in good regard. You're talking about an ambassador that had spent years garnering relationships and garnering support for the American efforts to help the revolution in Libya. And arguably, Benghazi was a stronghold of pro-American feeling at the time in Libya. At least that's the reports that have come out even before and since the attack.
He was, the ambassador was something of a hero in Benghazi with certain people in Benghazi, but not everyone there. And it was 9/11. 9/11 is not a big deal, just a big deal in America. It's a big deal all around the world for those who would want to do harm to America. So, it looks as though we did not pay sufficient attention to some of these warnings about the exposure and weak and potential vulnerabilities of the two locations in Benghazi, the consulate, and then this other location, which was a largely a CIA-run operation, which was the second target. So there's the question, what did we do? What did we do wrong before that day? Well, we didn't pay sufficient attention. What did we do on that day? There's a big question about whether we responded with all that we could have. And then the third piece is, what did we do after that day? How did we talk about it? All three areas are legitimate areas of inquiry.
Carl Tooven.
Let's go back to the beginning and how he got there. First of all, as Alan has said, he was a big personality in this country and credited with doing a lot to bring things together. He might have felt in his own right, I can go where I want to go in Benghazi and I'm going to be okay because most of these people like me. That could have been on his mind. Secondly, I think it is important, as Alan pointed out, and I want to underline it, that budgets have been cut as far as security and safety of our embassies. Now, that might have been a very, very bad decision, which I think it is, and of all places to cut, it shouldn't have been embassies.
But Carl, let me interrupt you for a second, though. When you talk about budget cuts, there is no question that the U.S. government, through DOD, through our intelligence community, and through State Department down in Foggy Bottom, had made Libya a priority and had diverted money to support the operation in Libya, which I would think would include enhancement of diplomatic security. Does that not make sense?
It should. It should. And you know, as Alan pointed out, this was a CIA building spy. So what responsibility does the CIA have?
Let me just correct you on one thing there, Carl. The building itself was a State Department run building. It was, in fact, our consulate building in Benghazi. So, you know, were there intelligence operatives working out there? One could say yes or no. There are two locations. Where the attack happened was the actual consulate building run by State Department.
First attack.
Well, that's the attack that actually caused the damage.
The second attack also did huge damage.
I don't disagree with that. But what I'm saying to you is, you know, just in correction, is that the building where the ambassador himself and his three support personnel were killed was, in fact, a State Department building. And that's part of the argument. That's part of the argument that says, look, we diverted money as a government to support the Libyan effort. That should include, and in any other operation that I ever know about, it is always included enhancing security at our diplomatic facilities in country. Congressman, now you had a comment.
Well, we got so deep into the weeds on this one, I don't know if we'll ever get out. It seems to me that the irony here is that the Republicans moved very, very quickly to try to politicize this issue and try and see if they couldn't damage the Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, with this. If they had waited a couple of weeks, they'd have had two honest ones, which we will get to in a minute, and you will not hear me defending the administration on those. They'd waited, they'd have had some legitimate thing, and they wouldn't have had to muck this up. I think they've muddied the water considerably. Clearly, when you kill the ambassador and a bunch of other people, that requires an investigation. And then when the administration hasn't got its ducks in a row and says incorrect things, perhaps out of incompetence, perhaps that's being too kind to them, I don't know. But you've got a situation that you've got to deal with. But you don't have to politicize it, and I am still extremely irritated with Darrell Issa for having moved in and tried to make a partisan point on this when he didn't have to. An investigation, absolutely.
Yeah, but now, wait a minute. Congressman Al, respectfully, you know, when you talk about politicizing, Dianne Feinstein has come out and said publicly that the talking points after Benghazi were, and I quote, wrong. Those are her words.
I didn't say that there wasn't something wrong. I'm saying that ISIL tried to make a partisan pay out of it. It was a bad enough situation without doing that, and as it turns out, he didn't need to do it in order to make the administration look bad.
Bob Hines, you agree with that? That Chairman ISIL and the Oversight Committee politicized this? Or are they just doing their job?
I would have said just what Al said. It's in this kind of a situation, it's the mere fact that they're holding an investigation tends to politicize it. But it need be done. But it need be done in an appropriate way.
Was the ISA hearing last week appropriate?
I think it was fair.
Carl Tubin, you disagree.
When you mention the former Secretary of State 35 times in a hearing, and you kind of target her and other people target her, I don't know if that's fair or not. And also, there's the Pickering and one other person who
Mullen.
Has done a report.
Mullen.
Admiral Mullen has done a report. Two very respected diplomats, and ISA kind of.
Pickering, a former diplomatic corps member, Admiral Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But the funny thing about that is, in testimony, the key witnesses in front of the House Oversight Committee, not one of them saw the actual classified briefing that was associated with the after-action report that came out. The Accountability Review Board did not provide any of the key stakeholders with a copy of their report for comment, which I don't think that's politicization. It strikes me as, and I support John McCain in this, stinks of cover-up. Am I wrong in this, Alan?
Well, let me first respond to something that Carl said, because he left an impression that doesn't happen to be correct. He said that
we will get the facts.
That Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned 35 times. I think the number was 32. We won't quibble about that. It was first mentioned at the outset and 16 other times by Democrats who were trying to defend Secretary Hilton. But they brought Clinton brought her name up first. And went aggressively to sort of defend her before anybody had said word one about her.
Sit around and count the
number. Well, he's the one who brought up the number, Al.
But you seem very well informed on it. You're spending time counting too.
I didn't count. I'm reading what other people say, and I'm just trying to get the facts right.
What I'm doing.
But he gives the impression that a bunch of people 35 times are attacking Hillary Clinton, and I'm saying half the references to her were by people who were trying to defend her. Is this about Hillary Clinton? Not really, although for some people it is. The whole question, is this a meritorious or is this political? The answer is yes. It is both. It is both trying to figure out what the heck happened and how we stop it from happening again. And how it is political, you bet it is.
Bob Hines.
There's no way that it isn't both. Alan is exactly right. The reality is this kind of a thing is always political because, you know, it's the administration is one party, the House of Representatives is the other party's control, and they're obviously, when there's going to be an investigation, there is going to be politics on both sides. That's the way the world works.
Carl Tubin.
The whole thing is what Hillary said when she was before the committee, and that is that The important thing is to find out what happened, the truth about what happened, and also how can we try to defer this from happening again to one of our diplomats. That's the important thing. The all this other stuff is BS.
Bob Hines.
On that point, let me just step back a little bit and say something that I feel strongly about. No matter for what reason, no matter whether it could be successful, no matter whether we have any idea what would have happened, I have one really serious problem with the idea that nothing at all was done by anyone in the United States government, in any department or any place else, to try to do anything to protect or help the people who were in that building while the attack was on. Now, obviously, you're not going to be able to, there weren't any Marines around it like there usually are in a diplomatic area, but and they probably couldn't have gotten anybody from Libya. I don't know what could have been done. I have no idea, but I do know this. You know, southern Italy is only a couple of hours away by plane.
If that.
And they got fighter planes in southern Italy and a couple of bases down there. And if they did nothing but fly over the damn place,
well, Congressman Chavez,
might have done something good and nobody tried. Wait, let me finish one more thing because it really bothers me. You know, we have a wonderful way in our military. You know, they have a thing. Never leave anybody behind. When anybody's in trouble, get them out of there if they possibly can. That's what the military does to its own. We didn't, and this is diplomats, not military, but by God, we didn't even try. And it really upsets me.
Congressman Allen?
This is where I think the investigation should have been headed. I mean, we immediately, it happens, and they set out fighter jets to try to bring down the Secretary of State. Instead of asking all of the questions you just raised, every one of which is legitimate.
Which, by the way, those questions were asked during the hearing, and one of the most vocal members of the committee was Congressman Chavez out of Utah, who actually understands the synopsis, was calling out why weren't the ready response teams in Italy and surrounding areas mobilized at least in the air to try to respond to it.
I've got no problem with that. What I've got a problem is with the chairman, ISA, who is a partisan guy to his toes and who led off trying to make this as partisan an issue as he can. And as we're talking here, there's plenty of legitimate things to be raised. He didn't need to do that to put the problem.
Alan Moore?
Well, I have a little different view of how partisan this was from the outset. I think it was so rich with opportunity that he could... the chairman, could lay back just a little bit and they could have their cake and eat it too. They could look at the legitimate questions. What mistakes were made beforehand, what were made during, and what was done afterwards. And in so doing, you are going to bring up what personalities did. You're going to get changed documents in the White
House.
That's
my point, that if he had just laid back and let things roll out, he would have had everything he needed to make the administration look bad. Instead, he's blaming the Secretary of State before she's even heard about it.
I don't think he is that. Alan,
I don't
take that one.
I don't think he's doing that. I think he's maybe made that a mistake from time to time in the past. In this case, is that an objective of his? No doubt. Does he have to accuse her? No. Let the facts roll out, and it's not. And it's not
see,
so much.
See, you and I agree. Why are we disagreeing?
Well, because you're talking about how he handled the hearing last Friday.
No, I'm not.
I don't think he handled it the way you're saying he did.
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that the first words out of his mouth practically were that Hillary Clinton was somehow responsible.
I don't believe that's true.
Let me ask a question. Congressman, now. As the chief executive of the State Department, who is routinely briefed on security issues that are key, in key areas, i.e., in a country like Libya, does she not inherently hold a certain responsibility as to the overall protection of her diplomatic corps?
Of course, but what if anything went wrong there, was something to be determined by an investigation, not to be the lead from the chairman of the committee as to what he's looking
for. Carl Toobin.
Three things. Number one, Hillary took responsibility for what happened. She said, I'm Secretary of State, and it's my responsibility. Number two, the Speaker has gone crazy over Benghazi, probably thinking, oh, boy, we really have an issue here. And number three, Rand Paul has been out on the hustings talking about how Hillary should be ineligible for higher office or any office.
Last time I looked, neither Boehner nor Rand Paul sit on ISIS committee or involved in that investigation.
Correct.
People are going to say all sorts of crazy things.
Carl Toobin.
You don't think that the Speaker has any influence on the Rand Paul? I mean, not
Rand Paul.
I don't. On ISIS and what ISIS does?
Bob Hines.
Not much.
Bob Hines.
Of course, as the Speaker of the House, he has some, vague authority generally. I would suggest to you that if there's anybody who is a judicious and careful guy, it's the Speaker, number one. Number two, if there's anybody who is the opposite, it's Mr. Issa.
I would agree with that.
And if Issa had come up with the statement you made just a few moments ago, rather passionately, I thought, I would have had no problem with that. That is not what he did. And he didn't have sufficient evidence, in my judgment, to do anything.
We do have a disagreement on what exactly he did.
No, I agree with Alan Moore on this,
and I agree we're not going to solve it today, but one of the things I do want to point out is that the attacks on the administration and on the State Department and on Hillary Clinton are not necessarily just sided with the Republicans. I mean, Dianne Feinstein has been very critical in this situation, and believes that there needs to be further investigation.
I agree with her. You're missing my point. My point is that before anybody had a chance to figure out what they really should be doing, and they pretty well have now, that the Republicans were after Hillary Clinton and the administration.
But Al would disagree with you, because when you have an accountability review board who was chaired by a distinguished member of the diplomatic corps and a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that is submitted to the State Department and not given to the key stakeholders for their review.
Talk about in the weeds.
But that's part of the argument.
What I am saying is very, very simple. If the Republicans had merely let things unfold, they would be in the position they're in now, very frankly. And they wouldn't have had it smudged with an effort on partisanship. And then they have handed two great Christmas gifts with two other issues following it up.
Which we're going to be talking about here in the next minute.
And you'll find me much less defensive on those.
What
Bob Hines.
That probably says is if the two discussions we're going to have in a couple of minutes had come earlier, at the same time or ahead of the Benghazi issues,
right,
we probably would have not had such a heated conversation
exactly
here, because right, because we probably would have less of an ability of ISA to make as much as he did of it and stay to the facts and not try to go too broad. Reality was, now we've got a situation where there, every time you turn around, you open the door, there's another scandal going on.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to let that be the segue into our next segment. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other two scandals that are facing the White House right now, that being the AP and the IRS scandal. That's going to take up a whole hour of discussion, including our special guest at the top of the hour. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know. But you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
All of our blood pressure has gone down.
Yeah, we've had a little bit of a decompression mode.
Rest during the break.
We're continuing to talk about the scandals plaguing the Obama administration right now. What we've got right now is a situation dealing with the IRS. For those of you who were so attached to Benghazi, just when you thought it couldn't get any better, now we find out that the IRS had been targeting right-wing conservative groups, including the several Tea Parties in several jurisdictions, to see and claim that their 501c3 status was, in fact, either not valid, illegally gotten, however, but this has now come into a whole nother mess. Congressman Al.
And it might be worth noting at the beginning of the discussion that there is nobody around this table that I am aware of who's a particular fan of these ultra-right-wing groups. So whatever we say is not going to be primarily partisan, I suspect.
Well, let's go back and look. Apparently, this was brought to light inside the IRS when acting IRS Commissioner Steve Miller was informed that the IRS was targeting conservative groups. This is according to our friends at Politico, back in May 2012, when he was a deputy commissioner then. It was brought up when these conservative groups went to members of Congress saying, hey, we're being bullied by the IRS. We think this is political. Things came out. Certain comments were made. Lo and behold, we have a political mess at the IRS. Congressman Al, I'm sure, regardless of partisanship, when you use the IRS for blatant political gain, that's got to be troublesome to you, even as a seated member of Congress.
Well, it is, and it was. The IRS had a reputation 20 years ago for just being flat-out mean, if not partisan, just being very, very harsh about how it went about its job. And what I suspect is that the people behind this probably are not very good politicians, because they didn't handle it in that way.
So they
may not have been doing it with partisan motive. It still is absolutely wrong. No one, the tax system should never be used to investigate that kind of thing.
But Bob Hines, you're talking about this going on during a heated congressional campaign in the, I mean, literally in the middle of what was a torrid campaign to begin with. This does not bode well for the administration.
Apparently, according to an inspector general's report, an internal inspector general's report in the IRS, as early as 2011, the Cincinnati office at least, as well as an office in Laguna Niguel and someplace else in California,
right,
were doing this kind of thing with respect to right-wing organizations. And this was known in a, this is in a report that the inspector general made, and literally it was a year, approximately a year later, when there was a congressional hearing about this, and the then the acting director said, in effect, they weren't doing this. So something is kind of crummy there in the IRS.
Well, I mean, and you, there's other people. I mean, you look at the former head of the IRS, Shulman, Doug Shulman, who basically told members of Congress when this first came to light in the congressional offices, mainly at the district level, they said, no, this is not going on, this is silly, it's just something that we do as part of our mission. This is absolutely not the case. He's going to have to be held accountable, as are the people who are actually doing the auditing. Alan Moore, I mean, in a time where the IRS doesn't have a lot of favor, in a time when they're talking about reforming tax codes, then this, I mean, how big of a shite storm does this become for the Obama administration, along with all the other stuff that we're going to talk about?
This is about as bad as it gets. What this particular item brings forward is memories of Richard Nixon and his abuses of the IRS. There are other people who have used the IRS. But if you are a president of the United States in modern times, the last thing you want is a reference to Richard Nixon and to your own administration to be in the same paragraph, the same sentence, the same article. And that's what you get here. Now, is it the same thing? No. No. President Nixon used to had a team of people identifying people who he wanted to have harassed by the IRS. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the first who did this. It didn't start with Nixon. Nixon took it to new heights. This doesn't reach that level, but what this does is it smells like that. It has a whiff of that. It's a decision made by the group of folks that oversee tax-exempt organizations, and all these new applications that were coming in, who do we look at? How do we pick them? Well, let's some of these new right-wing groups, let's at least take a good look at those. How do we identify them? It's you can see how mid-level bureaucrats might think that would make sense. The problem, again, is once it became known to higher-ups, it was not stopped, it was not acknowledged, and even in the last few days, misleading comments were made about what was done. This is a big-time disaster.
I mean, Carl Toobin, I mean, this does scream of Richard Nixon and Watergate.
No, it does scream of Richard Nixon and Watergate. The problem is that the IRS and this particular group in Cincinnati, which I think is kind of the home of where these investigations come, a few years ago, they came after veterans organizations. And I do work for Vietnam Veterans of America. We weren't targeted, but other veterans organizations were. So, you know, it's something that these people decide to do, and they go out and they do a lot of other 501c3s to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, this is outrageous. I mean, as a liberal. And I don't have any tact for Tea Party or whatever and the right wing and the whole thing, but this is over the edge.
Now, for the record, the White House has claimed total deniability in any knowledge of this actually happening, even as far back as 2011, even as far back as 2012 in May, when then Deputy Commissioner, now Acting Commissioner, was notified that this had been happening. Alan Moore.
Yeah, the only exception to that so far, and I wouldn't be surprised if this is the only one in fact, White House counsel, the White House counsel, was informed on April 22nd, so the report goes, that the Inspector General of the IRS was doing a report and this was the issue. Apparently, this kind of information gets transmitted constantly. The White House counsel's antenna didn't jump forward to say, What? I need to know more, because when is this going to come out? It actually came out semi-accidentally last week as the head of this unit at a conference was asked about this issue and talked about it because she knew the IG report was coming out. Once again, the White House did not get out in front of this issue, which it would have been hard to successfully tamp down, but for them to be surprised like that, except that the White House counsel's known for 3 weeks, it's just a little one more unfortunate piece of the thing.
But Congressman, now, when you look at the fact that White House counsel was notified back when, and it took the news breaking of this happening to get the Attorney General Eric Holder to start a criminal investigation on this out of DOJ, does that surprise you? Does this look like a knee-jerk reaction out of the Obama administration?
Let me answer that this way.
Okay.
I think that I can recall back when the IRS was doing all kinds of really mean things to all kinds of people, and it didn't have a partisan touch at the time, but it was rough handling by bureaucrats of American citizens. And I remember that I went to a friend of mine who was on the Ways and Means Committee and complained about it, said you should have some oversight. And he said, and that's what I'll bet you almost all of these guys were thinking, they've got a tough job. You know, they've got to enforce these rules and what have you. And he kind of passed it off. And he was a good friend of mine, and I was a little surprised about it at the time. I think people can lull themselves into the belief that these guys are just doing their job and it's a hard one and we need to support them, rather than saying they've got a job which inevitably will get very close to this kind of thing and should have tough oversight within the agency that they are not doing this kind of thing. So I think that went from the White House to Holder on down through the IRS and all the rest. You probably have got less evil intent here than you do in Benghazi and some of the other issues, but it still says that we've got an agency that has the capacity to grab you by your private parts and jerk hard, and that agency needs to be watched very, very carefully.
Bob Hines.
To follow up on what Al said, because I agree exactly, it seems to me that the one thing that a president doesn't want to have happen is being in the Oval Office when the tax people are doing something wrong.
Or like targeting here. political organizations, targeting the opposition, yes, during
exactly.
Every election year.
Now, because everybody pays taxes. Everybody wants to believe it's fair. Everybody wants to believe everybody's treated the same. Everybody wants to believe they're playing above, with the rules. And when they discover they're not, it's the worst thing almost that can happen to the White House, because that's the one thing everybody in the country has to pay taxes and nobody likes to.
Carl Toobin.
You know, part of it, I hate to say it, is the negligence on this administration. Sheldon Cohen is a good friend of mine. And he was IRS commissioner under Lyndon Johnson. And he told me many times, Lyndon Johnson would call him and say, come down to the White House, I want to talk to you. And they would go down to the White House and Sheldon would have his people carry two or three valises with them with stuff that they were working on. And Johnson would ask him, what's going on in the agency? What are you working on? What is good, what is bad, and there was communication. Now, we don't know how much direct communication there is between the commissioner and the president. And if there was, this might have been handled a lot differently.
But Alan Moore, when we talk about, and I concur with Carl on this, is that the direct line of communication, the commissioner of the IRS does have to operate his own agency. He doesn't have to bore the day-to-day operations of the organization to the White House. However, the second that report gets to White House counsel, which arguably might as well go in directly into the Oval Office, at that point, there should have been either a response, an investigation, or something to dampen, at least get in front of the issue.
And I absolutely agree with you, and there wasn't that kind of sensitivity to this. They're just doing their job was probably what went through that their mind, too.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, I'm still trying to catch my breath after Al's reference to jerking hard on private parts. But in response...
I wasn't talking about yours.
Oh, no, thank God.
No, I assumed you were talking about your own.
Family show, kid. Family show. Family time.
I thought we escaped the bad part. Bringing it up.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that picture. Alan Moore, finish up. Alan Moore, finish up.
He puts on his cup.
Who brought up masturbation?
Ow!
Well, I didn't bring it up.
Can we? Yeah.
Sequestration? I thought we were talking about.
Here we go. So anyway, keep going, Carl. Keep going, Alan Moore.
The problem here is that if you just look for what the White House counsel heard a few weeks ago and today, this is the kind of thing that a well-functioning operation. Little antenna go off, you say, uh-oh, what do we do? We got to get out in front of this. This is going to come out soon. We need some heads to roll because this is a case where, sadly, you do need heads to roll. No White House, as Bob sort of alludes to, is so stupid as to try to use the IRS anymore. I mean, that is, if there's any no-no.
That's so Watergate. That's
there,
so 1970s. Right.
It's so, what you don't want to do. And I think, for all the mistakes this White House makes, that is not a mistake that a White House would have made. The mistake here was not communicating appropriately, not showing immediate outrage, not having a plan, if you will, to being forewarned to be ready to respond. Now what we've got is another major investigation, and it may be that the Justice Department, which has sullied itself on this AP business, which we're going to talk about later, but it is the governmental agency that would be doing the investigation of the IRS, does not have the kind of credibility, especially this week, and there will be calls for a special committee, a select committee,
Does this warrant independent counsel?
Well, it may. Not because I love independent counsels, because I'm not a big fan, but because of the caca storm that we're wrestling with, and DOJ's own problems from this week, from Fast and Furious and other things, that they're going to have to think hard about whether they need some kind of independent investigation.
Congressman, now I want to pose that same question to you. Does this warrant independent counsel? Is DOJ so muddied in all this that there should be an independent counsel called
for? I think it's premature. It's possible, but I think it's premature. It looks to me like you're dealing with incompetence here, not evil intent. And
certainly doesn't look that way, though, Congressman.
What do you mean it doesn't look that way?
Again, this screams of Richard Nixon and creep all over again.
No, it doesn't.
Look.
I've already explained to you. Let me put it this way. Who was it that said, what we need is somebody who's run for county commissioner in this area? The IRS needs a politician, somebody who understands politics. Not there to protect Republicans and Democrats, but there to say, fellas, you're too close to the line, and this can blow up in the president's face. And I think that if the agency sets up some kind of oversight, like it should have a Republican and a Democrat retired, not to protect partisanship, but to understand politics and be able to explain it to otherwise a bunch of accountants who haven't got any sense of it at all.
Bob Hines.
I think that it is probably wise for the administration, if things get any deeper, and I don't know what's going to happen, an independent counsel might be good to take the heat off the White House. I mean, if the White House, I don't think the White House knows anything at all about it. But the fact of the matter is, if they keep trying to be the defender of and check it out and do it, it may look like, you know, they're trying to protect themselves. An independent counsel may be the best thing they could have to have an independent decision, you know.
It's an interesting talk.
Carl Toobin.
Well, two things. First of all, Holder has asked the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia to start an investigation on Friday. That's number one. It happened this afternoon. Number two is the first thing that should have happened is when the counsel in the White House saw this, should have handed it right over to the Chief of Staff and might have even informed the Vice President's staff about this so they could all start to work on this and to kind of see what it is and work out a plan as to how they're going to answer all these questions.
There's no question that the White House is literally just punch drunk from this particular scandal. Jay Carney today gave a presser about this where he was questioned, and he couldn't tap dance faster than Fred Astaire around it. His big quote was that he's getting now a lot of heat for is, quote, "We need the independent inspector general's report to be released before we can make any judgments. You know, one person's view of what actions were taken or what that individual did is not enough for us to say something concretely happened that was inappropriate," unquote. Now, Jay Carney is taking a lot of heat for that answer. This is something that a lot of people in the White House apparently knew about way back when. Alan Moore.
Yeah, we'll find out how many people knew what. Jay Carney, let's face it, has had not just a bad week.
He's had a bad second term.
He's had a bad year. And we've talked about this in the past. But on Benghazi, he got his private parts in an awkward place when he said, oh, we only changed one word before the final talking points. Never mind. There were 25 different changes, talking points that the CIA prepared. Pardon me for counting here, Al. The first one, I didn't count all the words. The first one had 19 lines of writing. It bulked up to 26 lines of talking points and ended up at 8 lines of talking points. That was what Carney characterizes, one word got changed. And then he's tried to tap dance on that, and he's tried to tap dance on this. I believe that one of his first reactions to this was, well, the commissioner who was in place at the time was a Bush holdover. Tax commissioners, as Carl can tell us, these are tax jocks. For good reasons, they're not politicians. They're people who are acceptable to both parties. This guy was accepted to a 5-year fixed term by a Democratic Congress because Bush set up a name that was acceptable to the Democrats. These guys aren't politicians. They're not supposed to be. But, as it's been said, they would benefit from having a county commissioner around or somebody with a little bit of political smarts to say, whoa, don't do that. Don't do that.
Bob Hines.
I just want to say that I feel so sorry for Jay Carney. I mean, any way he looks, he's getting pie in the face or something worse than pie in the face. I mean, he's got to go out there.
He's got to go out there and
every day he's got to talk to the press. And there is nobody saying, how's your mother? They're asking a whole lot of hard questions, which he doesn't know what the answer is to, and there is no good answer he can possibly give.
Congressman, I'll let you go first, and then I'll comment, then Alan Moore. Go ahead, Congressman Al.
Well, it just occurs to me that this administration has developed a political brilliance in terms of election campaigning, how to get elected, and you can't really fault them for not being very good at that. I don't think they know diddly about
once you get elected
the small p politics of working things out, and it showed up in so many other ways of the how the president handled the health care bill and so
yeah.
forth and so on.
Alan Moore,
you know, it's interesting. Being press secretary to a president is a very tough job. Carney's not doing it very well. Now, would that matter? It hasn't mattered a whole bunch because we can argue about this if we want to, but I think there's a fair amount of evidence that the press has been pretty darn kind to Obama, and they're taking flack for that, and so there's a little built-up feeling about, no, we're not, we're fair, we're reasonable, and now this comes down, watch out.
You know,
when you turn the press and you add in the AP piece, watch out for this press
corps. You know, I gotta tell you, though, you know, in Jay Carney's defense, I mean, first of all, Jay Carney has just, I mean, you want to talk about somebody that's taking a right hook every day for the entire term that he's serving right now. Jay Carney is giving the message that he is given by the White House communications staff, by the chief of staff, by the president's political leaders. He is just giving a message. And I got to say, Jay Carney is being vilified. He's giving answers and tap dancing as quick as he can. He just can't drink from the fire hose quick enough.
Well,
Bob,
the first rule about scandals is get it out fast. Get the facts, know what happened, and get it out fast. This White House seems to work on a different theory. Let's dribble it out. Let's kind of bob and weave, and it only gets worse and worse and worse, i.e., Nixon. I don't think there's anything like Nixon going on here, but you get the same problem. People start looking at it and saying, my God, there's worse stuff than I can believe. What else is going on?
That leads to a good point. I mean, is this something that could do irreparable damage to the administration? Congressman Allen, I'm going to start with you.
That requires one to look into the future more than I am able to. But potentially, of course, if things go south from here on. But
Bob Hines?
We're going to talk about the AP issue shortly. My guess is that the press is going to stop being as kind to the president as it has been in the past 4.5 years. I think there are going to be more sharp questions. They're going to go in not so much as adversaries, but, you know, prove it to me you're right. I think he's got a permanent problem that has happened, given the situation, not of the scandals we've talked to so far, but the one we're about to talk to.
Yeah, I'm going to segue into that. When we come back, we're going to have a special guest, Lisa Wilkin, who is the chief political and government reporter for the Claremore Daily Progress out in Claremore, Oklahoma. She was just voted the best new journalist by the AP for government reporting that she's done regarding, you know, inappropriate behavior by government officials. And she's, in fact, knows about what it's like to be on the back end of having a government agency come after you. She'll talk about that here in a second. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us for the second hour.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland Scotches, they've got Isle of Skye Scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
Washington, D.C. It's the best political show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. And it's the top of the hour, which means that we're ordering our drinks, cutting open our cigars for our second hour of what has been a scandal perfect storm for the White House show. Joining us right now out of Claremore, Oklahoma, is the chief political reporter for the Claremore Daily Progress, the newspaper that brought us Will Rogers to fame. She is Celicia Wilkins, the best new reporter in Oklahoma. How you doing, Celicia?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing fine. Thanks for joining us. What we're going to talk about is the issue of the AP situation. For those of you who have not seen the past 24 hours, it was reported late yesterday that the Department of Justice served subpoenas on the Associated Press, taking large-scale email accounts and...
2 months.
I'm sorry?
2 months.
2 months. Of email accounts, phone records, including desk phones and cell phones, and Alan Moore.
It wasn't emails.
It wasn't emails. Just phone records.
Right. Several individuals and then some centralized offices.
Right. So basically what we've got is a Department of Justice subpoena being served, those records being provided in accordance with the subpoena, but when asked about it, the Department of Justice doesn't give an answer. It is very vague as to why and how the reason came up for this. Alan Moore, let's start off with you.
Well, the subpoena was not served on the AP. The subpoena was served on the phone network. So they got this information for a 2 month period of last year, but only recently informed the AP what they had done, prompting the AP to write to the Attorney General saying, in effect, how dare you?
Right.
And we want all of our records back, or all these records to be destroyed, and then publicized it. So that's how it
Hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be, America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also a place for private parties. You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings. Famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich. The sandwich named after me. Breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. The premier sponsor of Backroom Politics. You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Backroom that really know how to pour a drink, whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more time. One more once.
Now, if you've got a central phone line and you got a
Hey, welcome back to Backroom Politics. Sorry for the technical. You know, when you run a live show, it is absolutely amazing on how this goes. We're going to continue on this on the topic, and we'll rearrange the show. But this is obviously a topic we want to go back on. What we're talking about is the recent AP story that came out yesterday, where the Associated Press found out that the Department of Justice had served a subpoena to the for the phone records of various reporters, their desk and cell phones, and basically came out and said, hey, we're just going to take these, giving no reason whatsoever. It is called into question. The reasoning, and it is called into question, a lot of First Amendment rights here. It is a very sensitive situation. Joining us on the phone right now is Sleisha Wilkins. She is the chief political reporter at the Claremore Daily Progress in Claremore, Oklahoma, the newspaper that gave us Will Rogers. And she has also recently been named the best new reporter by the AP. Sleisha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Sleisha, real quickly, the story of the AP broke yesterday, and it's calling into a lot of issues. This is a very dicey, thin line we're dealing with. As a reporter, how does this make you feel? I mean, this has got to give you a little bit of pause, knowing that the DOJ can do something like this.
Absolutely. I know that they've called it outrageous and appalling, but I call it obnoxious abuse of government power. One thing that nobody has mentioned yet is the impact this will have on a reporter's ability to obtain a source. Of course, we're dependent on sources, and if I was working at the AP and this happened to me, I'm pretty sure I'd have a lot of people that would not be willing to talk to me after this. And it goes so much farther than just the inconvenience of being able to tell a story. Their real issue should be with the individuals that have agreed to their security clearance and not with the press. We're simply trying to do our job, following our First Amendment rights, and this thing is kind of, it's just blown way out of proportion. It's scary, truthfully.
Sleisha, now you have been reporting on government for a while. You broke a story regarding a congressman that came out of that area and some possible ATF dealings. You also have been writing stories regarding the actions of the district attorney down there. You're familiar with how government sometimes crosses a line in First Amendment rights, freedom of the press, and protecting its own operation. Where does that line cross, at least for you?
Well, I think one of the biggest obstacles I face is it's kind of the government gets real defensive about their transparency. Everyone likes to give it lip service, but when actually providing records to the public, it's a completely different story. Where I kind of consider this issue with an AP and obviously an offensive measure, you know, they're not even asking for permission. They're just going in and taking what they want. For me, every day, I'm constantly requesting you know, everything from email documents to court documents. And, you know, here, as of late, I've just been told flat out, you're not going to get them. And it's very frustrating as a reporter because it's prohibitive. It doesn't allow you to do your job. I don't even know how to describe the frustration level and the excuses that constantly these government officials hide behind. They're hiding behind their legal attorney-client privileges, their rights under different laws. It's kind of an issue where the First Amendment is superseded by any other legal precedent that's been upheld by the Supreme Court. And I'm sorry, it's very frustrating, and there's a lot of things that I can't discuss because of the legal action that I'm involved in, but I will say that the public should become more aware about what their rights are under the First Amendment, what open records are available to them, and they should start speaking out, because if they don't, we're going to see more and more actions, you know, not only like the ones I'm dealing with, but the ones that the Associated Press is now dealing with. That's going to become more commonplace, and it will affect everyone.
Celicia, can you talk about, you know, there's work coming out of Claremore that there were destruction of emails inside the DA's office down there. Can you talk about that?
I really can't talk about it at this time, but I can tell you that there are definitely some high-level government agencies that have looked into this issue, and I think they will continue to do so.
Yeah, Congressman Al, you are, prior to being a congressman, you were a Emmy Award-winning broadcaster. You know, when you hear the stories, excuse me, when you hear the stories coming out of, you know, out of Celicia and the story coming out regarding the AP, why is Congress not more fired up immediately about something like this? And as a broadcaster, you think that every media outlet in the world would be concerned that they're never going to get another source again.
Well, of course, and Elisa, I think.
Celicia Wilkin.
Pardon me. commented on that, I think, very effectively. The thing that troubles me is, in the years that I was in the business, it's all changed. And what has changed is you no longer have three networks, and that's it. And those were all, I would say, highly professional and objective.
And responsible.
And responsible entities. Now, I don't want to drudge up, and I use that word intentionally, what has happened since. But now you've got all kinds of people that are doing very questionable things in the media, using the First Amendment as a protection for things that I'm sure Walter Cronkite or David Brinkley would have been appalled by. And it makes it extremely difficult then for guys like us and you, Celicia, to make some distinctions, because you want to protect the First Amendment, but you also want the news media to be relied on by the public and to be trusted by the public. And the cable things are really, I think, beginning to erode the ability to think.
Bob Hines, you were the former vice president of government affairs for NBC, a major network media outlet. How would you have responded to the subpoena had this been served on your organization?
I would have called the general counsel and said, you take our part, because I ain't going to get near this thing. But the truth of the matter is, I think Alan is exactly right. The world has changed a great deal. We don't have the same kind of self censorship, if you will, of in sensitive areas that we used to have. Now the idea is to rush out and get anything you can and throw it out in the public eye. Now, and it kind of, I think, debases good journalism. But the fact of the matter is that anybody gets a hold of something, they're gonna put it out there. Now, that doesn't mean that the Justice Department can go and subpoena people, the APP news people, they ought to at least have to be told what people are looking for in the Justice Department. I mean, I find that really offensive.
Well, and let me add,
Congressman Al,
so that my earlier remark, this is wholly unjustified, they've done to AEP, and I'm not suggesting that's not the case. I'm merely suggesting that some people in the media fuzzed the line so that you don't know whether you're defending good journalism or whether you're defending everybody that wants to just throw some crap out there and see if it sticks.
And most journalists...
I'd like to add something to that.
Yeah, no, Salisha, please do.
Okay, first of all, I think that journalists do have a certain amount of accountability, or they should. Ethics should be their top priority. Everybody would like to get the first story out there. They'd like to have the breaking news event. But there has to be some accountability, and that should come from their editors and their publishers. If you have a journalist that's not acting appropriately, then they just need to be fired, in my opinion. On the second side of that, if the government is allowed to do things like this, what's going to be next? Are we going to have to present our stories to them to read before they can be published? I mean, there's a clear line here, and they've crossed it. And the government should be accountable for their actions. You know, I would not be a bit surprised if there's going to be a huge lawsuit that results from this.
Alan Moore.
Well, I think accountability is going to come both in the political process and through the news media. It's rare that you see politicians united, and in this case, united with most of the news media. Everybody is trashing the administration on this one. Now, having said that, there is a legitimate reason for the U.S. government to try to protect certain national security information, national security secrets. The particular issue that triggered this whole god-awful business was a major breach of security relating to something that happened in Yemen when we were able, through a source, to identify the possibility of a American airliner getting blown up. Well, that information that allowed people to figure out who the source was released. That was a horrendous breach, and that was against the law. Was it against the law for the press to publish it? Interesting question. I don't think so. It was against the law, though, for some U.S. government official to share that information. And this kind of thing happens from time to time. And the Justice Department goes after a reporter. And we've had reporters who spend time in jail. When a judge orders them to give information and they don't, they're held in contempt and they spend time in jail. It's a serious business. What's unprecedented in this case is, in light of that particular fact, the Justice Department said, tell you what, we're going to not only gather information on the people who are both reporting and editing this, we're going to get information from 20 other phone lines that 100 different reporters use. That's the unprecedented piece. That's the piece that really frightens everyone. And as Salisha says, that's what scares people into being a source. There are people who might have been a source on something going on at the Agriculture Department who were talking to an AP reporter during that time period and suddenly figures there's phone records on that. What's happening to those phone records? Oh, my gosh. Am I going to get fired? Is somebody going to point at me? It was the scope of this subpoena and the information that was gathered that has rallied everybody to this cause.
Yeah, and Salisha, I know you can't talk about it, but, you know, I mean, this is not only at the federal level. I mean, you're experiencing some of this down at the state and local level as well. This has got to give you pause as far as your ability to do the job of reporting sourceable, reliable facts to the public as information.
Absolutely. People don't seem to understand how difficult it is to be able to report a story with accurate facts in a small town. I mean, everybody knows everyone here. And to get a source that's trusting you and will turn over information that they know could potentially have them, you know, fired, there could be charges filed against them, they could be ostracized. I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen to a source in a small town. It's difficult to develop those relationships, and when the government comes along and criticizes work that you've done because they don't like the end result of that story, yeah, people get gun shy. They run away. They don't want to do it. And now when you have you know, on a federal case here where the federal government has crossed that line, I mean, I can't imagine how anybody would want to talk to a reporter. I mean, and without those people that are willing to risk so much to make stories happen, to make sure that people see into what all the dark corners have of government, and you know, how in the world could we possibly have any change in our government without that kind of transparency? I don't know. I just find it to be extremely difficult to see where this path is going to go, and how any journalist can possibly continue to do their work without questioning who's looking at what I'm doing, who's going to be, you know, looking into my records.
Carl Toobin.
I think what has been done is wrong, and I think though that we have to look at where we've come from. When the Yemen situation occurred, there was an outcry by both Democrats and Republicans and the president saying that we are going to go to the ends of the world to find out who leaked this information. And I think that part of that outcry kind of maybe gave a little impetus to the Department of Justice to say, okay, we really need to find out what's going on with these leaks and where is it coming from and what is it. Now, why they only seemingly only went to the AP to do this, and especially going into the press room and the House representatives and tapped all those phones is beyond me. But I think you can kind of see how this built up to where the Attorney General might have said, well, we've got to find out. Everybody's saying find out where it came from.
Alan Moore.
One of the things that we'll have to figure, that we will eventually learn here, is whether this is an unprecedented one-off case that was so extraordinary that for the first time ever, the Department of Justice extended its reach so broadly into a particular news organization. If they decide, if it's concluded that this had never happened before and darn it, it's never going to happen again, then the question is, will people believe it? And that gets to the point that Salish is making. This may have been so unique that it hasn't happened before, and given the universal condemnation that has occurred, it may never happen again. But a lot of damage has been done. And who will make that determination that never happened before and hey, trust us, won't happen again? There's Humpty Dumpty sort of fell off the wall and is broken, and it's really going to be hard to put him back together, given the extent of this outrage.
But I guess, Alicia, the question to you would go that, you know, if this were a matter of national security, and a lot of times you see that, you know, national security is very much subjective. You can't report this because it'll violate national security, whereas this is a key fact that the public has to get out there. How do you balance that with you, your editor, and your publisher out there in your paper, or as a reporter in general?
Well, first of all, you have to have a good relationship with the people that you're, you know, not only your sources, but your local government officials, regardless of whether or not, you know, they're a fan of your work or not. You have to develop at least one person in that organization that you can trust, that you can go to and you can say, okay, this is the information that I have. Can you give me any feedback on what the long-term impact is going to be if I break this story? You know, you try to do what you can on that side. If you can't, you know, it's truly a judgment call, and you know, that's not something I make by myself. I'm just a reporter here, but you know, I'm always looking at the worst case scenario. You know, because it is important for reporters to consider the impact of their work. Now, saying that, there's also you have the responsibility of what will happen if I do not tell the story. You know, what is the potential outcome for the public if they're not informed? And so you have to balance those two. I think one thing that's interesting with this case is that there's no talk about all the other options that the Department of Justice had. Did they exhaust those? Why didn't they get the phone records of their employees? You know, people that they're looking for this leak. Well, these people, they obviously know their obligation if they're government employees. You know, why didn't they do that? And then the fact that they're not really offering any real explanation for why they would go after these phone records, I mean, that's just as troubling as what they've done. And I do believe that, you know, if you look into it, you will find that there are probably other instances, probably not 20 lines, but there are probably other instances where they've kind of crossed over into that gray area. This one's just hit so close to home for me that I question, is this just a gateway drug of government action for what they're going to do next?
Wow, good point. Salisha, is this reporting coming out of AP going to make your job harder as a reporter?
Well, I think if on a probably any high-level story that I want to do with people, other government officials or things like that, that sources I have, they're probably going to think twice about it. But locally, most of the people here, they're very selective about their national news. I'll just put it that way. They probably aren't going to pay that much attention to it, but I'll be thinking about it.
Very good. Very good. Hey, Salisha, thanks for joining us. Thanks for putting up with the technical issue. We'll definitely have you on again as things develop on this. Salisha, and congratulations on your award.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Not a problem. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Salisha. When we come back, we're going to go into free form, go into Tell Me a Story. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Everybody knows Shelley's Back Room for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Hey, misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner.
And we're back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is our final segment, and our favorite segment, Tell Me a Story, where we talk about all the news, innuendo. I mean, we can't top the three scandals that are going on, but eventually somewhere there's got to be another story out there. And again, our thanks to Salisha Wilkin from the Claremore Daily Progress for joining us last segment. I'm going to start with you, Bob Hines. Tell me a story.
Thank you, Justin. I am fortunate enough to be a trustee of the Gerald R. Ford Foundation. I have been for a number of years. The introductions say every week, you know, I used to work for Mr. Ford when he was minority leader of the House, and I was also his counsel, his parliamentary counsel on the floor. I was parliamentarian for three conventions, two of which he managed as chairman, and I worked when he was nominated as vice president when Mr. Nixon had the problem and with Mr. Agnew had to resign. So I had a long history with him, and I have been a member of the board for many years, and it's a great honor for me to be sitting at a table with people like Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft and Jim Baker and you name it, and they're sitting right next to me. We're all talking, and it's a wonderful experience. Well, this year, 2013, is it's centennial of his birth, 100 years. He died about 45 years ago. And so the event of the annual meeting of the board of trustees was, we moved from Washington, which has always been, we moved up to Grand Rapids and had a most wonderful time up there. It was just magnificent. And instead of having just business meetings and things of that nature, we had several opportunities just to talk about Mr. Ford, either informal ways with members of the media who knew him, members of his own staff who wanted to talk about it, and anybody who wanted to get up and say something. And it was so moving to listen to people talking about a man who had great integrity, who took some very tough decisions, including one that may well have cost him the election, the pardon for Mr. Nixon, which everybody has agreed was the correct thing. And I wanted to just tell a couple of stories that are, one of them is funny, and the other one is shows you the kind of a man that Mr. Ford was. The first story I'll tell you is that story. When he was president, he spent, as we all know, several major parts of his 28 months or so in the White House in international matters. You know, Helsinki Accords being the most, I think, successful and the most important. But he also spent a good bit of time making sure that the allies of the United States were allies. And he was on a trip to the Philippines and Asia. And before he left, one of the messmen in the White House, person who, you know, the mess in the White House is not, like a smorgasbord. It is a very, it's a
small dining area.
It's a small dining area.
We're not talking about Nixon.
No. It's a small dining area where the senior White House staff, guests who are in the White House, et cetera, have lunch, have dinner, have breakfast, whatever it is, as they work their way in the White House meeting structure. And one of those persons was a Filipino gentleman who had been there for about a decade, and Mr. Ford got to know quite well. And so when he was going to the Philippines, his staff had arranged to talk to the Filipino administrators who were handling the visit to say that he would like to meet the parents of this gentleman who he knew to be still living over in the Philippines. And Mr. Ford wanted to meet them and say hello and say how much he appreciated their son's work in the White House. And he had finished his meeting with President Marcos, and they were getting, they were finishing their meeting, and the First Lady, Imelda Marcos, came into the room. And she said to her husband and to the president, I'm sorry, Mr. President, but we cannot be at the state dinner we're having tonight. He just wouldn't be appropriate. Mr. Ford said to the president of the Philippines, I'm sorry, but it won't be appropriate or possible for me and Betty to be at the state dinner unless this couple is permitted to be there. I want to meet them, and I want to thank them for the wonderful son that they had.
Wow, that's a great story.
Can you imagine everybody just about choked?
Yeah, oh, I can imagine.
It's amazing.
I can imagine.
That's the kind of a person Mr. Ford was. I mean, the Nixon pardon was not something he did because he was trying to help Mr. Nixon. He was trying to get it behind the country. If it cost him the election, he was going to do it. I was right there when he did it.
Right.
I was there when he signed.
That's a great story about a great man.
I'll tell you one other story, because this is a funny story.
Okay.
And we'll end this on a happy note here.
Okay.
The story is about Mr. Ford when he was minority leader, and Tip O'Neill, his great friend, who was the whip in those days. They'd been out playing golf. They had a drink in the clubhouse. They were walking out to the parking lot to get in their two cars and go home. And Tip and Jerry had their arms around each other, and Tip said to Jerry, and I know this for a fact because this story I told at the group, and I heard it separately from Jerry and from Tip, so I know it's true. They walked out, Dip puts his arm around Jerry. He says, what are you going to do tonight, Jerry? He says, oh, we've got some friends coming in from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Their kids went to school with our kids. Everybody's in the house. We're going to have some hamburgers and cook out in the backyard and just have a good time. Okay. And Kip said, that's wonderful. That's a great thing. And Jerry said to Kip, what are you going to do tonight? She said, Jerry, I'm going back to the office and figuring out a way to blank you tomorrow when you leave the house. And the two of them fell in each other's arms just because they loved each other. And that's how it worked 30, 35 years ago.
How
and
we wish
boy,
it
don't
say.
We wish it could be that way today.
Alan Moore.
Well, I too have the pleasure of working for Gerald Ford. I worked on the domestic policy staff in the White House for him, and I'm reminded of two things that happened with Ford and the man who was my boss, a man named Jim Cannon. Now, Jim Cannon died a year and a half ago. He was the biographer of Gerald Ford, and the volume about the Ford presidency was actually published just this week in time for this centennial event, and it's a really interesting work about a special man who was an accidental president, ridiculed often, vilified, but who was quite a remarkable man and quite a healer in the country. Well, my friend Jim Cannon came down with cancer in the mid-70s and became a cancer survivor. And while he was working on the book with President Ford, they were talking. While Jim's his condition was still uncertain, Ford came to visit Jim Cannon and said, and they were talking about cancer. He said, you know, when my wife Betty went public on her breast cancer, it was such a big deal and so highly publicized that doctors all over the country reported that literally hundreds of thousands of women were coming in to learn how to do a self-examination and getting tested. And he said, Betty's courage in going public has saved untold numbers of lives. Well, I tell that story because I want, as a lead-in, to a shout-out to the news today
Angelina Jolie has
undergone a double mastectomy and reconstructive surgery. And by going public, this is all preventative. She's apparently got something like an 87% chance of developing breast cancer because of her some unique aspects of her DNA, family history, et cetera. She had the courage to do this, to write about it in the New York Times, to talk about it and be talked about. And untold thousands of lives will be saved.
Absolutely.
Because of her courage. A shout out to the late Betty Ford, and also to Angelina Jolie.
Absolutely. Joining us on the phone right now is our international expert, Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, tell me a story.
Thanks, Justin. Recently, the North Korean president met with President Obama in Washington, D.C. By all accounts, it was a very successful summit. But one of the issues that most people don't realize came up, and that was South Korea's relationship with Japan. President Park expressed great disappointment with the Korean-Japanese relationship, and she's asked Obama to help in terms of improving the relationship between the two countries. However, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will present to the Japanese shrine later this summer, where many soldiers from the Japanese Imperial Army were honored and buried. Many years ago. And this is going to hurt Japan-South Korean relationship at a time when Obama needs both Japan and South Korea to be on the same page to provide a united defense against North Korea.
Wow, great story. Thanks, Ralph. Real quickly.
Take care, guys.
Hey, thanks, Ralph. Real quickly, I want to give a shout-out I want to take moderator privilege here real quick. This past week, I was up in New York for two very meaningful events. The first one was my godson, my nephew, received his Eagle Scout. What I didn't realize is that he is the third generation Eagle Scout in our family. My father was an Eagle Scout, one of the youngest in New Jersey history. His oldest son, my brother Doug, was also an Eagle Scout, and now his son is an Eagle Scout. I could not be more proud. The second event was I was there to watch my oldest nephew graduate from SUNY Maritime. You hear me on the soapbox about the American flag merchant marine and how wasted it is. This is a kid who went to SUNY Maritime on scholarship and wants to give back to the U.S. Merchant Marine community. He wants to join the Coast Guard and eventually go to sea. And I got to tell you something, as an uncle, I could not be more proud. Could not be more proud at all. But it really took me back. I'm going to take moderator privilege real quick. Al, again, yes. Al, Carl, in 2 weeks, that's the other thing I have to announce. Next week, I will be in the garden spot of Paris, Texas. We will have a best of show next week, which will compile several segments of several shows that we've done over the past year. We're going to put that together. That will be our best of next week. The following week, we will be live again, live from Shelley's back room. But when we come back, Carl, Congressman Al, you guys get first shot on what? Carl's giving me two fingers. I don't know what that means.
Two stories.
You get two stories. I'll give you two stories. You always say two stories. With that, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, Carl Tuven, Dr. Ralph Winnie on the phone, special thanks to Celicia Wilkin, our special guest from the Claremore Daily Progress, our producer, Alyssa Bonk. I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We'll be back live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
Boy, devil, isn't this the place to be?
It is when we get these technical issues worked out. Folks, have a great week. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.